Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On board today with us, Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Donna.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Dennis is with us as well. Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science at Drake University. Good day to you, Dennis.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Donna.
Hello.
So much to get to this hour. Later in the hour, I'd love to find out, Dennis and Donna, your thoughts on that. The professional athletes taking a knee during the national anthem, the president's reaction, the national conversation that's been started by that, ignited, I guess, would be a good verb to use there. We also want to get our listeners' views on that. Email us with your reaction, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. How do you feel about our president making this issue a national conversation? We'll talk about that a little bit later in the hour. You can email us your reaction, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Plenty of things to get to before that, Donna and Dennis. Let's talk about that victory in Alabama for Roy Moore yesterday. Luther Strange was appointed to replace Jeff Sessions when he became attorney general. He is the first incumbent to lose a primary in 5 years. Let's listen to Roy Moore, both at his victory speech last night. Roy Moore voiced his support for President Trump. He continued his campaign message of what he called bringing the understanding of God and faith back to government.
Don't let anybody in the press think that because he supported my opponent that I do not support him and support his agenda. As long as it's constitutional, as long as it advances our society, our culture, our country, I will be supportive. As long as it's constitutional. But we have to return the knowledge of God and the Constitution of the United States to the United States Congress.
Okay, this is Roy Moore. He brandished a revolver during a rally on the eve of that runoff. He's been suspended twice, I believe, as the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court. He disobeyed a federal judge's order to remove a statue of the Ten Commandments from the state judicial building. Donna, talk about this win by this particular candidate. What your thoughts are now that he has won over the Luther Strange, backed by McConnell and the president?
Well, it really set up kind of a showdown between Roy Moore, who's very much a reactionary, a movement evangelical, conservative Christian, has been really pretty high profile if you pay attention to politics in Alabama in particular, but has made national news before with his removal from the Alabama Supreme Court twice, as you mentioned. And then Luther Strange was, the state attorney general. He was the quote-unquote establishment candidate. He was appointed by Governor Bentley to fill Sessions' seat, and then Governor Bentley himself had to resign because of a scandal in his administration. And so Moore was endorsed by certain people in the Trump orbit, like Steve Bannon, for example. But Trump himself endorsed Luther Strange at the urging of Mitch McConnell, it appears. And Trump even appeared last week at a rally for Strange, and even himself at the time kind of doubted his endorsement publicly out loud. This is also when he started talking about the NFL as well at that particular rally. And so, one of the things I think this tells us about Trump is that Trump is Trump, and it's not clear that the Trump phenomenon is transferable necessarily, because there were a lot of people who were Trumpish, if you want to use that word, that supported Roy Moore, but Trump himself supported Strange. And I think one of the takeaways that we might get out of this from Trump is that, Trump, I think's gut told him to go with Moore, but he was convinced by people in the Senate to go with Strange. And he then became establishment in that sense. And we may see Trump, not doubt his gut as much.
Mm. Dennis, your thoughts?
Well, I'd second pretty much what Donna said. I mean, Roy Moore has had his own particular orientation, his own particular reputation long before the Trump movement. I think he just attached himself to the Trump movement and vice versa for this particular race. But he's always been a fringe figure. As you said, he was suspended twice from the Supreme Court of the state of Alabama. for, despite all his concerns about what's constitutional, he denied the Supremacy Clause, which said that the U.S. Constitution and laws and treaties enacted in pursuance thereof are the supreme law of the land, anything in the state constitutions or laws to the contrary notwithstanding. And he just said that Alabama did not have to obey a federal exposition of what the Constitution said. So he has been a fringe figure, but there's been a solid core of support in very rural parts of Alabama, much of which may be rural anyway, I'm not sure, for him all along. And as I said, he connected himself with the Trump movement, which was against what the Trump people always say are these out-of-touch establishment of elites of both parties. And Karl Rove is concerned that Roy Moore may be this year's Todd Akin.
And remind us of Todd Akin.
He was the one who talked about the concept, in his words, of legitimate rape in 2012 and lost an election to Claire McCaskill that a lot of people thought he could have, or a mainstream Republican candidate could have won. And so Republicans may have to spend a lot of money helping Moore across the finish line in Alabama, even though Alabama is a very, very red state.
Any chance that the Democrat would Alabama, right? It's not going to happen. Right?
That's true, but it depends upon what more moderate or mainstream Republicans might want to do, because Moore is such a polarizing figure there, just as we saw that many mainstream Republicans just recoiled in horror from Todd Akin in Missouri.
Mm-hmm. Donna, where does this leave Donald Trump, who in this case, and I have to say it this way, backed a loser?
Well, he apparently immediately deleted some of his tweets, in which on yesterday during the time that people were voting, he had tweeted out some things supporting Strange, wanting people to go out and vote for him. He apparently deleted those tweets and then also came out and endorsed Moore, which is no surprise in terms of that endorsement. And he said at the rally for Strange on Friday that if Strange lost, he would endorse Moore. And indeed, he has done that. And so, it might tell us that Trump is Trump. And that's kind of a unique feature that he may not be willing to, or he may not be able to, translate into popularity. Also, we might talk about the spending in this race as well, because a PAC associated with Mitch McConnell put in about $10 million in this race, vastly out, and that includes the before the original primary before the runoff, and vastly outspent more in the runoff. And money didn't seem to be the deciding factor, obviously, in this race.
Mm-hmm. Let's take this together and perhaps a bigger picture in context here. Yesterday, also the news of Bob Corker, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, announcing he won't seek a third term in 2018. I guess it's becoming clear from what I've read after he is clear he would face a well-funded primary challenge from the right. So what do you see going on here? Is this part of a larger trend, Dennis, the end of an era when deal makers are vanishing? We're having more moderate voices. We have John McCain, of course, a giant of the Senate, battling brain cancer, a prognosis there that's not good. We're electing members of Congress who prefer to sort of pour sand in the gears.
Well, American politics has operated, broadly speaking, in terms of a center-right and a center-left for quite some time. And with the rise of the Tea Party movement, particularly on the Republican side, they've pushed past a center-right to really a hard-right position. And I've distinguished on the program before between right-wing and left-wing populism. Left-wing populism says the little guy's getting a raw deal because of the wealthy and powerful above him. And right-wing populism says the little guy's getting a bad deal because those undeserving types are getting the benefit of government largesse. And the Republicans have ridden this tiger for quite some time, this kind of right-wing populism, and they're in danger now if they try to get off because, these are the Trump supporters. They're Trump supporters before they're Republicans. And Roy Moore is an example of this kind of right-wing populism. So Republicans are going to have, I wouldn't say a civil war, that's too high-powered of a term, but still, they've really got to deal with what they want their party to be. And of course, Steve Bannon has one idea of what the party should be. And people like Bob Corker and John McCain have a different idea of what the party could be. I think we're in for some tough times and even tougher times in American politics.
Does this primary victory
have implications for the Democrats in the Senate, the moderate Democrats, perhaps, Donna?
Well, it certainly has implications for Republicans because, you know, Corker was concerned about a primary challenge. We know that two of the most endangered Republican senators, Dean Heller and Jeff Flake, are probably going to get primary challenges from the right. But you might see some similar kinds of things on the left, although I don't think the movement on the left is quite as strong as we see on the right, where there has been a threat since the 2016 election aftermath that, you know, Democrats might be challenged in primaries by the left, by people who were part of the Bernie camp as well. And anytime I think that you see people looking at primary results and seeing challenges from the left or the right be successful, it may embolden people in other states to do a similar kind of thing. But we need to remember that state dynamics are different, and the dynamics between the two parties in this sense are different as well. And it's always in the interest of any party to try to minimize divisive primaries if they can. That's at least what they try to do.
Donna Hoffman with us, Dennis Goldford as well. Politics Wednesday on River to River. We'd like to have you join our conversation. A little bit later in the hour, we'll talk about that NFL anthem, national anthem controversy that erupted. I guess the igniter was Friday night, a rally that the president spoke at, his comments then and on into the weekend, and consuming not only NFL, but also the basketball, the professional basketball players as well. But first, let's talk a little bit about the failure yet again of the GOP health overhaul. The last-ditch effort to pass an overhaul of the ACA before the end of the month failed yesterday, pulled from consideration by Majority Leader McConnell. Now, remember, for 7 years, Republican politicians promised to repeal and replace Obamacare. Yesterday, they once again failed to follow through. Here's Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican, speaking on the failure of the so-called Graham Cassidy bill and the next steps to repeal and replace ACA.
The leadership team has done everything we've asked them. We're coming back to this after taxes. We're going to have time to explain our concept. We'll have a better process, and we're going to take this show on the road.
Okay. Also today, seconding that, the President Trump said the attempt to repeal and replace Obamacare isn't dead. Tweeting this morning, we will have the votes for health care, but not for the reconciliation deadline of Friday, after which we need 60. Get rid of the filibuster rule, the president tweeted today. So, Donna, tell us about this. So we have maybe a little bit of explanation here. The September 30th deadline will pass without any action, and the president wants the Senate just to go with a simple majority in passing legislation?
Right. Well, there were some, you know, there's some kind of complex budgetary rules in Congress, which frequently they ignore. But one of the things that they can that allows them in the Senate to get around the filibuster is reconciliation. And that expires. It's a mechanism within the budget resolution. And that expires at the end of the fiscal year, so September 30th. And it's not something they have an option to do in the next fiscal year. And so then any bill that they would take up on health care would need to be able to surpass that cloture vote, which is 60 votes, that then allows them to take a vote. So it's not actually technically correct to say, you know, things need 60 votes to pass in the Senate. They need 60 votes to shut off debate, and then they take a majority vote after that. But it is common practice now that things are routinely filibustered in the Senate. And so it makes this a hard row to hoe for the Republicans because they only have 52. And they do have the vice president. They lost the three. They couldn't even bring it up for a vote in this sense. But it's pretty clear that what the tea leaves are saying at the moment anyway is that they're going to stop on the health care. They're going to maybe take up the bipartisan effort to kind of shore up the markets right now, and that they're going to go to tax reform.
So is that really the only option, the bipartisan fixes for the present Obamacare, other options?
It's only, I think, the realistic option at this particular period. Now, whether they can even do that, I think, remains to be seen. But there was already a bipartisan effort in the HELP committee in the Senate with Senator Alexander and Senator Murray to try to do some stopgap kinds of things in terms of some things that Trump was maybe threatening to do regarding the CSRs, as they're called, the cost-sharing reductions that the insurance companies get to keep prices down for low-income people. And that is actually something Trump can do administratively. These are paid month to month. The September ones apparently have been paid, but he's never been really clear as to whether he might stop those at some point, and that's always been a threat. So Congress was hoping, or at least the Senate anyway, was hoping to do some legislation to kind of shore that up, because the uncertainty here, will we repeal it? Will we replace it? What will we replace it with? Won't we do this? Has caused uncertainty within the market. It's not necessarily that the Affordable Care Act is failing in that sense. It's that the uncertainty is making it quite unstable, and they're trying to shore that up to make insurance companies happier, to make people who are insured happier, et cetera.
Right. Briefly, Dennis, perhaps you can tell us about what you think are the implications for the GOP leadership here. As mentioned, the Republicans have full control of the federal government, both chambers of Congress, the White House, the Supreme Court, you could say, with that. But they are failing to capitalize on this. What does this mean for Mitch McConnell? Do the knives come out now? Have you seen any of that?
Well, you can't beat somebody with nobody, and there's no obvious replacement at this point for Mitch McConnell. But I would say that Republican candidates for president, whether they won the nomination or not, ever since Obamacare was passed, have said with great bravado, on day one, the first thing I will do is repeal Obamacare. Well, they simply could not do that as a matter of statutory and constitutional law. They were promising something they simply could not do. And now they're hoisted by their own petard. I mean, they're in the situation of saying we couldn't do what I said we would do, even though they had to have known. If they couldn't, it was political malpractice. They could not have done this. But that's why the Republicans have been so desperate to get anything that they could classify and call a repeal of Obamacare. Now, the main fear of these Republicans has been precisely what seems to have happened, is that once it was enacted and starts to operate, it might sort of sink its roots deeply enough into the soil that people will get used to it and wouldn't want it taken away from them. And that's what they've been dealing with now on the part of Republicans from particularly states where they have some tremendously vulnerable populations, even though many Republican states refuse to extend Medicare and avail themselves of it. So Republicans, as Donna said, have had 7 years to deal with this, and they haven't. They've just played it for political effect, and now they're paying the price.
Let's go to our phones. Dennis Goldford with us. Donna Hoffman, our political analyst on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Nick is with us in Des Moines. Coming up on a break, Nick, but please, welcome to the program. Share your thoughts.
Glad to be in. Thank you so much for taking my phone call. I think my biggest thing I look at with healthcare is where there's no negative downside to talk about. And we're seeing the same premium increases that we saw from last year. We're seeing 20,000 Iowans that'll get kicked off if nothing happens with the stopgap bill currently being passed by the insurance leaders in Iowa. And so I really want to highlight that I feel as if the media isn't bringing forward, and I don't want to make it a mainstream media debate, but the media isn't bringing forward that Obamacare is not working. And the fact that the Republicans are totally failing and not bringing a solution to the table doesn't mean that it's not failing in its own right now and it's going bankrupt.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think Donna brought up the point. It's sort of hard to separate. You know, we have the uncertainty introduced by the political debate and controversy. The uncertainty, how do you separate the uncertainty, instability from the problems that were in Obamacare to begin with?
Yeah, and then on top of that is kind of an interesting thing. 80% of the increase is going right back into claims. So the 50%, so $100 is paid, 80 of those dollars are going back towards the hospitals, towards claims and so forth. So it's not as if the insurance companies are out there to get rich. They just can't afford it. And so I was footing the bill. I mean, we have an individual that costs $1 million a month, and we're failing to get the public, I feel, angered about not the political parties that are involved, but rather the true cost, and that it's ineffective right now and the pay structure is not working.
Thank you, Nick, in Des Moines, for that call. Let's talk about tax reform before the break quickly. Republicans unveiled today their plan to cut taxes by more than $5 trillion over 10 years. Not really revealing how to pay for it, though. This afternoon, the president will be giving a speech here in the Midwest in Indianapolis about tax reform. Senate Majority Leader McConnell spoke on the Senate floor this morning. He explained the outline of what Republicans hope for in a tax code overhaul bill. He says it will make taxes lower, simpler, and fairer.
It's a refreshing change from our current outdated tax code, which for too long hasn't worked for many Americans. The current code forces individuals, families, and small businesses to navigate a web of schedules, deductions, and penalties. Rates are too high. Incentives often make little to no sense. Some actually encourage companies to ship American jobs overseas. Moreover, for 8 years under the Obama administration, our economy grew at a sluggish rate, never living up to its real potential.
Leader McConnell was followed by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat. He says that the details he has seen of the plan will not help middle-class Americans and instead will be what he calls a massive windfall for the wealthiest Americans. Schumer says eliminating the tax estate, for example, would only help the wealthiest.
This is not going to fly with the American people. Let me tell you, our Republican colleagues tried to do something the public disliked on health care, taking away benefits, reducing health care. Now they're trying to do the same thing on taxes, helping the very wealthiest. They're going to be in for a rude awakening because the American people are going to rise up against this.
Chuck Schumer there. I didn't think he was quite done, but evidently he was. We have a couple minutes before the break. Dennis, start us off here briefly. Tell us, what do you see in this rollout? We don't have a lot of details. We heard in the news a few of them.
The original estimates without the details is that, at least in the language in which it's been discussed, would be that, yes, over half the benefit of tax reform and tax reduction, and those aren't the same thing, would go to the highest incomes. But almost all economists across all political spectrums believe that ideally, if you broaden the base, you can lower the rates. The problem is everybody's got a vested interest in a particular deduction, be it the estate tax, charitable deductions, mortgage deductions, and things like that. And, you know, the Trump administration will say that the U.S. is the highest tax nation in the world. That is simply not true. If you look almost anywhere in the European community, they have higher tax rates than the U.S. does. So we're not the highest tax country in the world. And even with the official rates, almost nobody pays those nominal rates as they are. So this is a difficult thing to do. The last time it was done at the fundamental level was in 1986 with the Reagan administration, and that required Democratic and Republican cooperation. Will we get that this time?
Right. Donna, 30 seconds to go. Why should this pass in the Republican Congress if health care, the overhaul there, failed?
Well, I think it's going to be difficult for them to do. As Dennis mentioned, you know, somebody's ox is gored with all of the things that they want to change. And those groups, especially in the area of tax reform, can be very organized, can mobilize usually pretty quickly to protect their interests. And that's why it's really, really difficult to do tax code reform.
Okay, we'll be back with Donna Hoffman and Dennis Goldford. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, our politics, political analysts this week. We'd like to have you join us when we come back. We're going to be talking about that big blow up over NFL players refusing to stand for the national anthem. Where do you come down on that? Your thoughts on professional athletes taking a knee during a national anthem? How do you feel about our president taking this issue to a national conversation? I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River, 1-866-780-9100.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, and Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science at Drake University in Des Moines. Join us as we talk about the big news of professional sports getting mixed up with politics. A lot of people saying, why does that have to be? Sports Illustrated headline, it's not every day that a U.S. president goes to war with American sports. I want to talk a little bit about this, the big blow up over NFL players refusing to stand for the national anthem. Now, it was started last Friday, the president wading into the issue at a political rally when he bemoaned what he saw as a decline in the sport. He criticized players who want to draw attention to what they believe is social and racial injustice by refusing to stand during the anthem. On Sunday, we witnessed the president's comments sparking a swift and widespread rebuke from the NFL. Players, coaches, owners kneeling, locking arms, staying off the field during pregame ceremonies.
At a joint press conference yesterday, this was with the Spanish prime minister, President Trump said he is ashamed of what is taking place.
Many people have died. Many, many people. Many people are so horribly injured. I was at Walter Reed Hospital recently, and I saw so many great young people, and they're missing legs, and they're missing arms, and they've been so badly injured. And they were fighting for our country. They were fighting for our flag. They were fighting for our national anthem. And for people to disrespect that by kneeling during the playing of our national anthem, I think is disgraceful.
Now, the president was responding to questions from a reporter asking whether he was preoccupied with the NFL national anthem protest. Well, he should have been focusing on response to hurricane damage in Puerto Rico. It widened on the weekend, too. Trump tweeted a rebuke to Warriors. The Golden State Warriors guard Steph Curry, captain of the 2017 NBA champions, who on Friday had reiterated his stance against the team's celebratory trip to the White House. Donald Trump's tweet, "Going to the White House is considered a great honor for a championship team. Steph Curry is hesitating, therefore invitation withdrawn." Let's hear some comment from Steph Curry.
It's kind of, I mean, surreal, to be honest. I mean, just, I don't know, you know, why he feels the need to target certain individuals, other than, you know, rather than others. I have an idea of why, but it's kind of it's just kind of beneath, I think, a leader of a country to go that route. It's not what leaders do, so.
Okay, Steph Curry there. Perhaps we can reach out to you. What are your thoughts on professional athletes protesting? How do you feel about our president taking issue with this? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Dennis, your thoughts. So many aspects of this, but what jumps out at you?
Well, you know, someone once said that the world is equally shocked at hearing Christianity criticized and seeing it practiced. And I think by parallel, in some ways, you can say the world, or at least Americans, are equally shocked at hearing the principles of the American constitutional order criticized and seeing them practiced. I mean, a lot of Americans will speak very piously about our constitutional rights right up to the point at which somebody actually begins to exercise those constitutional rights. This is something Kaepernick started this, and nobody paid outside of the NFL and the sports world paid a lot of attention to it, the kneeling, until the president decided to make an issue of it. He tends to cater to his base. I mean, George W. Bush liked to say he was a uniter, not a divider. Not everybody agreed with that, but that's what he wanted to say. But this particular president seems to cater to his base alone, makes no attempt to reach out beyond it, and anytime he feels politically imperiled, presses the hot buttons that will get that base going. So I think that you've got the president making really a mountain out of a molehill, at the same for his own political purposes. At the same time, when these folks do this kind of kneeling, they're not actually criticizing the principles of American society or our political and constitutional order,
or the military.
They're saying live up to our principles. They're criticizing not the principles, but our failure to live up to those principles.
Mm-hmm. You know, this morning I happened to have breakfast with a group of people this morning, included a veteran. So I took the opportunity of asking this veteran, Matt Eckhart of Iowa City. He served 6 years in the U.S. Army, describes himself as a conservative. He says he wouldn't protest that way, but feels that protecting the right to protest is one of the reasons he served and what makes our country worth fighting for. Before we go to calls here, there are a few calls here. Donna, tell us, do you think this was a calculated move? I see people saying, oh, this is a master magician, Donald Trump. Again, the sleight of hand so that we won't pay attention to things like North Korea and the Russia investigations.
I don't think Trump calculates that much in this regard. And this is something, again, I was talking earlier about him. You know, he kind of does things from his gut. This is what he was doing on Friday and then on into the weekend when this became an issue. You know, this issue had largely blown over and no one was really talking about the role football players are playing in this kind of protest. But Trump picked it up. And one of the things it points to us is the perceived centrality of presidents in our system. I say perceived centrality because Americans think the president is the government. There's two other branches, and Congress isn't even in Article 1 of the Constitution. But the president has a platform, and this particular president has the Twitter platform in which he can cater to his base, and that's often what he does. And I don't think there's any grand design in him doing it. It's just decided that this was the thing he was going to pick up on because, again, he kind of mentioned it in offhand remarks at this rally with Luther Strange, mm-hmm. which was for a different purpose. It was to help Luther Strange try to get elected. And so I don't think there was any kind of master strategy here.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our phones quickly. Marianne in Ames. What are your two cents, Marianne? Welcome to the program.
Hi. I just have a couple points that I would agree. This isn't about the flag. It's not about the soldiers. I think what is really disrespectful is that it's our refusal of this country to address racial issues, and focusing on the soldiers and the flag is a way to skirt what probably most people don't want to have to face. I also think that if we want to talk about what's disrespectful, it's anybody flying the Confederate flag. The Confederate flag is a flag that represents a time when a group of people wanted to break apart our union, which totally disrespects what our flag stands for. And I have one other question for all those people who are criticizing the knee kneeling. Is do all these people who watch football at home and at the bars, are they standing up, putting down their beers, and putting their hands over their hearts when the anthem is played?
All right, Marianne, we'll let that stand and go to Brian in North Liberty. Brian, we're trying to click through a few opinions here. We're running out of time. Well, what do you have on your mind in this issue?
Well, my first issue is I don't see how this protest is solving anything. I believe that the national anthem is meant to unite us, unite the country, and obviously it's just dividing us on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, just
to be clear, Brian, so you're saying that you should stand quietly, hand on heart, perhaps, but certainly not kneel, it sounds like what you're saying.
Exactly, and I believe, agree with Tim Reynolds that you should be out doing something. These NFL players should be doing something else out in their communities or, with the Boys and Girls Club or something like that that would be more productive than dividing the country like it's doing.
All right, Brian in North Liberty, thanks. Let's go to Tim in Iowa City. Tim, in a nutshell, tell us what's on your mind.
I'm a veteran, and I don't see any correlation or connection with my service and the flag. And I don't have any problem with professional athletes kneeling on a Sunday afternoon. And just a comment on what Brian just said. There's a lot of NFL athletes that are very active in their community. A lot of these pro athletes spend a lot of money, a lot of time in their community.
Mm-hmm.
But my point being, as a veteran, I don't be dragging us into this issue. I don't see where that has any reflection on my service at all.
Mm-hmm. So the president there, you heard his words from a few minutes ago. He said you're asking the president not to drag you into this issue.
That's exactly right. I think he's an idiot. He's unqualified and he's unfit.
All right. All right, Tim in Iowa City. Thanks for your view, Kevin in Washington. Then we'll go back to our analysts. A lot of interest here, obviously. Kevin, quickly, what's on your mind?
I just think it's extremely unfortunate that the leader of our country is trying to deny constitutional rights of free speech while people in Puerto Rico are literally dying and can't get in, the help that they need, our own people. And it's just, to me, he's not leading from the front. He's leading from behind and just creating havoc.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin in Washington, Iowa. Now I'll throw in a poll number here before a final comment from Donna and Dennis. A majority of Americans disagreeing with the president's assertion that football players should be fired for kneeling during the national anthem, even though most say they would personally stand during this song. This is a Reuters Ipsos opinion poll released yesterday. 57% of adults do not think the National Football League should fire players who kneel. This included 61% of NFL fans. Split, though, along party lines, 82% of Democrats, only 29% of Republicans disagreeing with the president's here. With all those calls and this poll, Dennis, further thoughts?
I would say simply, and I think I need to check my sources because, again, I can't remember who it was, but somebody said that if dictatorship ever comes to the United States, it'll come wrapped in the American flag. And so I tend to be very suspicious if someone starts to use and appeal to the flag, patriotism, the military, and so forth, to make a political point and particularly to divide us. I get very suspicious of someone who makes that kind of claim, whatever party that person might be in.
Donna, before we move on.
Well, you know, we just had more callers on this issue than any other issue in the hour. And this gets Trump the attention that he craves. And we know that he really craves attention. And, you know, and it does deflect from his, you know, what he might be saying on Puerto Rico, because he didn't say anything over the weekend about that. And, you know, it is something that Trump is just going to do provocative things because that's what he does. And I think this is an example of that. And he keeps further fanning the flames here on this issue, too. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to some of those issues that some would claim have been diverted from by this NFL controversy. A political report, Politico report on Sunday said that Donald Trump's son-in-law, close advisor, Jared Kushner, and other current and former White House officials used private emails for their government duties. The U.S. House of Representatives, a committee there asking for information about this report, we're hearing now. So not only Kushner, Steve Bannon, Reince Priebus, Gary Cohn, the economic advisor. We're having the New York Times reporting. We also have private emails used by Trump's daughter, Ivanka, also when she became a White House advisor, by Stephen Miller, a senior Trump advisor. Comment on this revelation. Of course, we keep in mind, Politics Wednesday edition listeners will know that during the Trump 2016 election campaign, he hammered Hillary Clinton for her private email server use. Dennis.
Well, you've got, of course, Hillary Clinton talking about the height of hypocrisy here. And, of course, you've got Sarah Huckabee Sanders trying to say, oh, this is not the same at all. And we've told them to use proper government channels. But, again, this is one of these things that, you know, the emails let the Republicans play Inspector Javert from Les Miserables against Hillary Clinton. And they'll, you know, you could – I'm not a Star Trek person, but you could probably see some Star Trek episode in the future on the Enterprise, a headline coming over their teletype saying Republicans investigating Hillary Clinton's emails in the year 3033 or something. That's never going to go away. And you just have the Republicans guilty of the same thing right now.
Mm-hmm. How damaging is this if it turns out to be true? And it seems to be. Donna.
You know, it's one of hypocrisy. The optics of this are terrible, but I don't think, I mean, we've seen a number of these kinds of issues pop up in the young Trump administration, and his base is his base, and I do not think this is an issue that's going to turn them off, even though it's doing something pretty much of a kind as to what Hillary Clinton did. Certainly, there's difference in terms of degrees here, but nevertheless, if you focused your entire campaign on the issue of lock Hillary up because of her use of a private server and personal email, then I think you ought to be above reproach on this. And it's not as if they didn't live through that. I mean, apparently Jared Kushner set up this personal email in December. They had just conducted the campaign. He knows the problems with this, but it wasn't something that they took seriously. They literally talked about it. I mean, here we get back to the, you know, take Trump seriously, but not literally, perhaps.
I don't know. Of course, the backdrop, all these things firing off in current events, drawing our attention to them. Meanwhile, the Russia investigation continues, developments there as well. We heard in our Iowa news this week that Secretary of State here in Iowa, Paul Pate, says it's no surprise to him when federal officials last Friday confirmed Iowa's voter registration system was targeted by a Russian entity before the 2016 election. He says his office informed the U.S. Department of Homeland Security last year of the hack attempt.
Most of these hackers and even the foreign governments are looking for the low-hanging fruit. They're going on to the more public websites thinking they can find a window or door to get into the more sensitive material. And we don't do it that way. If you go into our website, you can hack all you want. The worst you could do is change some phrasing around maybe in my website, but you're not going to access any of our voter data or any of our business files. So that's why they aren't successful, frankly.
Okay. Iowa, one of the many states with attempted hacks here, other developments here. Donald Trump questioning on Facebook their decision to overhaul how it handles paid political advertisements and investigations into alleged Russian interference in the U.S. elections. Donald Trump, the Russia hoax continues. Now it's ads on Facebook. what do we make of this? The solid evidence stacking up, leaving no doubt of Russia meddling in our elections in many ways, and still we have a president calling it all a hoax, Donna.
Well, you know, we know that it's not. We know that these are legitimate issues, and there are a lot of these issues. Other countries are having these issues as well. And, you know, in case of, say, Facebook ads, you know, we have laws on the books that prevent foreign entities from giving money to campaigns, from buying ads for campaigns, if they run on TV, if they run on the radio. But, you know, here's an example where law and regulation hasn't kept up with the pace of technological change, perhaps. And so this is, you know, an area in which fast-moving developments need to be looked at by policymakers. And, you know, so far they haven't done that.
Mm-hmm. I'm seeing so many, you know, to keep it's a full time job keeping abreast of the developments in this Russia investigation. On Monday, Senator Richard Blumenthal, the Democrat from Connecticut, said Paul Manafort, Michael Flynn were, in his words, almost sure to be hit with criminal charges. His quote, "I'm about 99% sure there will be some criminal charges from this investigation." Do you see that in your view of it, Dennis?
Well, those seem to be the indications. There's been a remarkable lack of, or at least low number of, leaks coming from the special counsel's office. And I think for the Trump people, of course, they deny that there was any Russian interference in the election, because that would again lead one to question the legitimacy of the election, aside from the problems of the Clinton campaign and so forth. And of course, Donald Trump's going to deny that. But I think their big fear is that these folks quietly, out of view, are working away on some things that may, in fact, undermine the Trump administration. Now, that being said, you have to remember that if constitutionally we have a system of checks and balances, that works only if the checkers are willing to engage in the checking and balancing. And with Republicans in control of the House and the Senate, that's the question, what they would do in, if there is evidence of some malfeasance on the part of the Trump administration, which is a supposedly Republican administration.
Mm-hmm. Finally, let's get to North Korea. Thoughts on the escalating war of words between President Trump and the North Korean leader. Also, we're hearing of unprecedented nighttime sorties of U.S. B-1B bombers, F-15 fighters off the east coast of North Korea. Donna, how are you sizing up this brinkmanship going on? I guess a war of words is one thing. A hot war is quite a different thing.
Well, you know, there was some reporting out that people in some of the government officials in North Korea are reaching out to academics to have them explain Donald Trump and his rhetoric to them, because this is fairly normal rhetoric coming out of North Korea. It's not normal rhetoric coming from the president of the United States in terms of this ratcheting up and name calling and various provocations. And I find that quite interesting that the North Koreans don't quite know what to make of this. And I also think that's really dangerous when you have the high potential here for miscalculation and misinterpretation in two countries that have nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Are the countries moving toward a conflict, Dennis, or are these fears exaggerated? Is this sort of a tack that the president is taking to finally change the standoff with North Korea over its development of nuclear weapons and missiles?
Well, that's the question of how intentional and strategic this president is. And if Don is right, and I'm inclined to think so, he's somebody who operates more from his gut. But my limited understanding of his business practices is that he engaged in brinkmanship in terms of business, walking away from deals, threatening this and that. And the assumption seems to be that you can do the same thing in the Oval Office. Well, you can't really do that. And there's tremendous potential for miscalculation here.
Mm-hmm. Puerto Rico, quickly, thoughts on Washington's response to the devastation in Puerto Rico, also the U.S. Virgin Islands. Donna?
Well, I mean, this is Trump has come into criticism for his tweeting about sports over the weekend and lack of seeing some action in Puerto Rico and maybe some slowness in terms of sending some ships. And, you know, he even came back in the press conference with the prime minister of Spain yesterday, I believe, and said, you know, well, there's a big ocean between us. That's really not an insurmountable problem in terms of getting care to this area that is, you know, these people are American citizens. And it's an, you know, the population of Puerto Rico is actually larger than the population of the state of Iowa. And there's no electricity, apparently. There's little fuel. There's not clean drinking water. And these are all things that are problems that can be addressed with aid. But if that aid is slow, the situation becomes more and more dire.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, I heard a Democratic member of Congress saying this is a Donald Trump's Katrina. Dennis, do you think it's that?
Well, again, not with his supporters. They're with him through hell, high water, and hurricanes, evidently.
All right.
It remains to be seen.
All right. Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science at Drake University. Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Dennis, Donna, thank you for stepping into our studios today.
Happy to do so.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton with help from today from Robbie Broad. Also, Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks so much for all the input on this Politics Wednesday edition of our program. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.